Most of those who remained in places like Chatsworth, the border towns that bore the brunt of the Northerners' incursions, were holdouts. Everyone else had gone south, mostly to the high-rise slums that circled Atlanta. But it was the last stubborn few in the border towns who moved the street signs every week to confuse the soldiers, who spat on the floor at the very mention of blues. She found her old TikTok where she'd left it, by the side of Highway 76. As she traveled southwest into the protective embrace of Georgia, Surratt raised her head to the sky and screamed, victorious. She took the small back roads home, arriving in the early evening. Alight with adrenaline, she walked east from the edge of the woodshed into the forest. She walked carefully, counting her steps until she counted 500. At the last step, she stood in a clearing in the woods, near the riverbank. She knelt down and dug into the dirt. She buried her rifle. She left no markings of any kind and patted the dirt until it was flat and plain. Then she walked back home. From the edge of the yard, she saw the maid, Karina, in the kitchen, kneading dough and humming Jacob's Ladder. There was something about the woman she found foreign, more than her faraway place of origin in the Bangladeshi Isles, which left no markers on her mannerisms or accent. She smiled too often, carried herself too comfortably in a home and around a family that was not hers. Surratt could see that Simon had started taking a liking to her. She saw how his eyes and smile widened when she was near. She knew the woman had done nothing wrong, and yet Surratt felt a rabid urge to remind her that she was just a maid, that she was not of the chestnuts, and never would be. Surratt stepped between the trees and down to the water. She walked into the river. The water felt good against her skin. The night before, when she ran from the edge of Halfway Branch, she tripped and stumbled through a thistle bush that left cuts all over her arms and shoulders. Now the places where her skin was broken came alive, burning like flicks of oil against a hot iron pan. But this too, in its own way, felt good. When she had walked far enough into the river, and the ground swept down and away from her feet, Surratt undressed. She let the river take the soiled clothes. She floated, weightless, naked but for Albert Gaines's charm around her neck. The river smelled of dirt and algae, but it also smelled of her, the stink of a week unwashed, a vinegar effluent that grew in the spaces under her arms and between her legs. She loved her scent, carried it like her own newborn child. Now, with her eyes wide open, she sank deep into the water and gave it to the river. She felt the eyes of the guard in the tower, watching. There was only one tower along the quarantine wall, with an unobstructed view of the chestnut's property. Therein sat a young southern state private, charged with keeping the infected Carolinians from getting out. When the family had first moved to the charity house, Surratt refused to sleep another night under the watch of guard towers. Finally, Albert Gaines took her to meet the free southerner who manned the tower nearest her house. He turned out to be a hopeless little boy from the Georgia coast, a kid 1 year younger than Surratt, who'd lied about his age to volunteer. It didn't take long for Surratt to understand that the boy, and all the other boys dispatched to babysit Carolina's living dead, was both red-blooded and harmless. And in the months that followed, as she lay flat in the forest eyeing him through her rifle scope, she learned something else, too. The watchtower guards were blind. It was a blindness fed by boredom and fear, by having at once too much and too little to observe. Often, when Surratt lay watching, the sleepy-eyed boy in the tower looked right back at her and didn't see a thing. The river took her smell. It loosened the grime caught in the hairs along her arms and along her legs. When she was very young, her father told her that some of her ancestors were once buried near the banks of the Mississippi River, back when it was still corseted with levees. But eventually the river broke loose and took all the nearby houses and the farmland and even the dead in their graves. The river moves, he said. And as it moves, it takes. When she emerged from the water, she found a fresh set of clothes waiting on a rock by the bank. Dana sat by the side of the woodshed. There lay a straight razor and a small bowl of eucalyptus cream set atop a stump. Surratt sat by the river and shaved her head clean. She sat for a while watching the river move, savoring the crisp coolness of the cream against her scalp, the air against her skin. Then she stood up and dressed. She joined her sister by the woodshed. There was almost a foot of difference in height between them, Surratt pushing 6'5" and still, a year short of adulthood, not sure if she had another spurt in her. She sat by her sister's side. Dana's hair smelled of coconuts and jasmine. It curled the way waves curl, tinting the sunlight chocolate. Surratt could already see the boys in Augusta, leering.
"You should go inside and say hello," Dana said. "Simon's in a good mood today."
"He's saying much?" Surratt asked.
"Echo's what you tell him. But it's not nothing."
Surratt shook her head. "Give me a minute," she said. "I still got lightning inside me." She held up her right hand, which shivered like a picked string. Dana wrapped her arm around her sister's shoulder. Surratt leaned over and curled up like a child with her head on her sister's lap.
"Beautiful girl," said Dana. "I'm so glad you're home."
The sisters saw Karina in the garden. They watched her hang clothes out on the line by the riverbank. She pretended not to see them sitting by the woodshed. She sang as she worked, the same old hymn she always sang, playing her own choir, echoing each line. We are, climbing, climbing.
"She's taking good care of him," Dana said.
"I don't trust her," Surratt replied.
"What's she done?"
"Nothing she's done. Just something about her. I don't know what she really thinks of us, what she really wants."
"What do you care what she thinks of us?" asked Dana. "She's just working here, nothing more."
"She's in her home, isn't she? Anyway, she keeps talking to Simon and anyone else who will listen about how she doesn't care who wins, North or South, just as long as there's no more war. Like she'd be happy if the Blues marched on Atlanta tomorrow. You know her parents live up in the North? Moved there right before the war started."
"So? Wouldn't you if you had no stake in it?"
"Nobody has no stake in it," said Surratt. Night fell. A humid film spread over the air. Surratt awoke from a fitful nap with her sister's hand still caressing her head. She heard the sound of a motorboat engine in the distance, a rebel skiff from further inland.
"Why'd you let me sleep?" said Surratt.
"Wasn't long," Dana replied. "You were barely out an hour."
As the skiff landed, the sisters went to the woodshed and retrieved the most recent shipment of locked boxes. They carried them to the waiting boat. The boy at the helm of the boat, Anu Zuav from southern Alabama, thanked them. He took the boxes without checking their contents, knowing the arms promised him would be there, knowing from experience that the chestnuts were as reliable a conduit as any along the Savannah's smuggler's trail. They watched him leave upriver. When it was gone, and the grogginess of uninterrupted sleep had left her, Surratt became aware of the hunger eating at her stomach. The last of the apricot mush she ate in the forest had gone through her. She yearned for okra swimming in oil, pigeon grilled over charcoal, the cinnamon burn of tub brewed joyful.
"Let's go to Augusta," she said.
During the war, Atlanta was the heart of the South, but Augusta supplied the blood. Ever since the storms and rising seas swallowed much of the eastern coast, it was this place that functioned as the Red Country's most vital port. Toward the end of every month, 150 miles to the southeast, the foreign shipping vessels arrived from the far side of the world. The ship's captains waited there for reef pilots to come and guide the hulking freighters around the remains of the submerged coastal cities and into the Augusta docks. In anticipation of the ship's monthly bounty, an assortment of opportunists descended on the city. Ship hands, smugglers, rebels, reef pilots, foreign captains, and their crews. They were joined by sailors on leave from the impotent Southern Navy, whose skeleton fleet had long ago surrendered the ocean to the Blues. For a few days every month, the port's riverside bars and brothels and boarding houses hummed. At dusk, the dockmaster flipped a switch, and a string of Christmas lights hung along the boardwalk came to life.
The boardwalk sat atop the flattened head of the Reynolds Street levee, which rose 20 feet high. The river-facing side of the levee was sheer, except in the places where stairs led to the reef pilot's house and the wharf. On the city-facing side, the concrete slope was of a gentle gradient. And it was on this side where, in the early morning, many of the passed-out drunks could be found sleeping. By the time Surratt and Dana arrived in Augusta, the bars overflowed, not only with those waiting on the aid ships, but also with tourists from all over the Mag, in town to watch the Yossi. The sisters went first to the Hotel de Grub, near 12th Street. There was a gaggle of dockhands and Atlanta boys gathered on the lawn of the repurposed Baptist church, drunk and cheerful. In the center of the lawn, there stood an ancient Chevy fossil truck, mounted on bricks. The truck was brown with rust, its hood sheared off, a charcoal grill in the place where the engine used to be. Billows of smoke rose from the grill. The retired freight captain, Isaac, who ran the Hotel de Grub, stood between the truck's lightless eye sockets, a palmetto fan in his hand. He was a large man, shirtless, sweaty but serene under his skipper hat, despite the barrage of orange embers the truck spat in his direction. The smoke climbed from the blackened trays and made of the red brick church behind it a distant dream. "How are you, old man?" said Surratt. The captain turned.
"Well, now, if it isn't the only real goddamn men in Augusta. Make way, for Christ's sake,"
he said, kicking at two Atlanta college boys slumped on garden recliners near the grill.
"It's a zoo around this time of the month. You know how it gets when there's money to be had."
"Don't worry," said Dana. "We're gonna go inside and clean you out anyway. Haven't had a decent meal in a week."
The captain nodded.
"Go on in. I'll send some steak your way."
Surratt laughed.
"Ain't nothing like that flying steak you got here. You shoot him down yourself?"
"I'll shoot you down and you keep running your mouth. Flying steak's better than none."
The captain pointed to the grand bullet-head windows of the church's street-side facade. The original windows had been smashed long ago in one of the riots following the massacre at Fort Jackson, the insides stripped and looted down to the pews and the floorboards.
"Your friend Bragg's in there, by the way," he said.
"The old one or the young one?" asked Surratt.
"Ha! The old one can't get up to take a piss nowadays. It's the kid. Got his whole entourage with him, too."
"Christ," said Surratt. "Well, that's no fun."
The captain wiped the beaded sweat from his forehead and wiped his hand on the side of his jeans.
"He gives you any trouble, you let me know. I'll go in there and kick his ass. Don't care how united his daddy's little rebels are."
They thanked the old captain and went inside. Beyond the red brick exterior, there was little left of the original church, only the words, "And they went down both into the water," painted in an arch along the wall, and below it, a pale hollowness where once there hung a shining cross. The captain was a collector of long-dead things, species that had once existed but could not adapt to the planet's unbreaking fever. Taxidermied heads of caribou and muskoxen and sea lions and white-faced foxes stared down from the walls with marbles in their eyes. The dinner hall was full. The air was heavy with the smell of fryer oil and sawdust on spilled beer. The tables were arranged haphazardly throughout what was once a grand nave. In the rear of the room, a frenzied herd of line cooks moved in chaotic ritual around stoves and bubbling pots. The twins searched the room for a place to sit. Instantly, Surratt saw the men turn to watch her sister. Dana shifted the room's orbit, took charge of the air. The boys turned toward her like filings to a magnet's pole. Surratt waited for one of them to do more than look. Secretly, she hoped for it. They found a table in the back by the kitchen. But before they sat, one of Adam Bragg Jr.'s bodyguards came over and asked them to join his party.
"We're good where we are," said Surratt. "We'll be over in a minute," said Dana.
When the bodyguard was gone, she turned to her sister.
"Just a couple of minutes," she said. "Just to make nice."
"You know it won't be a couple of minutes," said Surratt.
"Why we gotta go make nice? We don't work for him. We haven't pledged allegiance to the United Rebels or anybody else. I don't give a shit about the United Rebels or anybody else, but people like him won't suddenly stop being important because we ignore them. Better to have him on our side in case we need him or his daddy's help one day.
God damn it, Surratt said, rising.
Can't even eat proper around them. Let's get it over with. They found the young man, who on this night was celebrating his 21st birthday, seated at a large circular table in a corner of the room. It was the only table in the place covered with cloth, and around it hovered a flock of bodyguards, rebel grunts, well-wishers, and hangers-on. Seated at the table were a couple of faces Surratt recognized, a well-known smuggler named Henson, Augusta's deputy mayor, the head of the Reef Pilots Union, and three other men who, by the stiff pull of their ill-fitting suits, were probably government men from Atlanta. The fractured politics of the wartime South dictated that high-ranking members of the United Rebels and the Free Southern State should not be seen socializing, given the diverging tenors of each on the subject of peace. But in Augusta, such rules were often temporarily set aside.
"Evening, ladies," said Bragg. "A true pleasure to see you. Sit, sit."
The sisters sat near their host. He introduced them to the table, loud enough so that the orbiting entourage could also hear.
"These are Dana and Surratt Chestnut," he said. "Survivors of the Camp Patience massacre and proud patriots of the Southern nation. I'm honored to call them friends."
"It's great to see you two girls,"
one of the suits from Atlanta said. Bragg introduced him as the director of the Free Southern States media operations for Northern Georgia.
"Aren't you two the sisters of that boy Simon, the miracle boy?"
"Yeah," said Surratt. "And whose sister is you?" The man looked at his host, the smile fading from his lips.
"Enough small talk," said Bragg. "Let's eat."
From the kitchen came a parade of bowls and silver trays, chicken liver, cracklings, rice smothered in red-eye gravy, corn chips and Mississippi caviar, beef that was not really beef but pigeon, charred black on the outside and pink within. The table descended into a glutton's silence, the only sound that of jaws and silverware. In the lull, Bragg leaned over to his guests.
"I heard you were out in halfway," he said. "That true?"
Surratt said nothing.
"Well, at least you made it out alive. Not many my father sends out there can say the same."
When the guests were done, the plates were cleared, and in their place came others. Trays of sliced peaches and watermelons and cantaloupes, jugs of ice water and lemonade and artillery punch. Until finally, those seated around the table could eat and drink no more. Tipsy and slurring his words, one of the Atlanta men rose to make a toast. He started with something about the Southern spirit and the great and noble cause of freedom, but soon he talked himself into a pretzel, until finally Bragg interrupted him.
"Let's just say, to the South, victorious."
"To the South, victorious," echoed the man.
The table raised their glasses. The men from Atlanta soon left. A few of Bragg's people took their place at the table. Among them were two of the Salt Lake boys, Truff and Cornhill. There had been six when the rebels first found them, orphans in the Battle of Spanish Fork, where the Blues, Mexican troops, and even a few misguided Texas outcasts fought to a standstill near what became the very northwestern edge of the Mexican protectorate. They were rumored to be the brood of Mormons. In the aftermath of the battle, the rebels found them hiding in a piggery on the outskirts of town and named them after the places they found them. Eventually, they were taken back south and drafted into the Bragg family's bustling orbit. The staff cleaned the tables and then brought out cigars and brandy. The cigars were from the old Caribbean islands, expensive and among the last of their kind. The haze that filled the air was sweet and earthy.
"You know, my father sends me out here because he doesn't trust me," said Bragg,
leaning close to the twins, high on the easy camaraderie of the freshly drunk.
"He says it's to make sure the supplies get past the Blues out on the coast and into the right hands, to keep an eye on things. But I think he just wants me out of Atlanta as much as possible. Afraid I'll kill him in his sleep, all that palace coup shit old men worry about."
Bragg laughed. He was looking at Dana, but watching her sister. He carried an effortless charm wielded almost exclusively by those born into comfort, or those who rose from nothing to achieve it. He smiled by default, teeth sheathed, eyes like pistol barrels, as though a camera lens stalked constantly on his periphery. He was gifted with a very rare and advantageous talent for seeming to speak intimately, every word a precious secret between old friends. Others came to the table, but were turned away. Rebels and would-be rebels, in the kin of both, all in need of favors. Dockhands and laid-off reef pilots looking for smuggling work, refugees wanting a room in the Atlanta slums, refugees wanting out. And then there were those men aligned with the groups who'd refused to come under the United Rebels' umbrella. They watched from tables at the other end of the room, observing the delicate fracture lines of the divided, wartime South. To Surratt, it was all nonsense, the petty turf wars of insecure men. Rarely a day passed without news of some fresh dispute between the Free Southern State and the United Rebels and the myriad fringe fighters who controlled swaths of territory in the border battlegrounds. Disputes over who should run the schools, collect the taxes, whose dead should place first on the murals. She had seen them do these things both publicly, in defiant, chest-thumping speeches, and privately, pragmatically, in the back rooms of Atlanta and Augusta. She saw them do these things, and she was disgusted by it. They were to her nothing more than prideful, opportunistic captains, arguing over the boundaries of long-obsolete star maps as all the while the opposing armada's cannonballs tore their hull to shreds. For Surratt Chestnut, the calculus was simple. The enemy had violated her people, and for that, she would violate the enemy. There could be no other way. She knew it. Blood can never be unspilled.
"Anyway, the old man will be glad to hear you made it out alive from halfway," said Bragg.
"Keep your voice down," said Surratt. "You want everyone in the place to know?"
"Don't worry so much," replied Bragg. "You're still new, still a ghost. Only people in this room who understand what you've been up to are at this table. And believe me, they'll have their tongues cut out before they say a word of it to someone who's not supposed to hear."
He turned to the two Salt Lake boys sitting at his side.
"Ain't that right?"
The boys said nothing. They sat as though encased in wax, no smile or frown on their lips. The elder of the two wore his hair parted down the middle, a child's haircut that made him look younger than his sibling, who had his hair buzzed close to the scalp.
"You know their two older brothers are already dead?" said Bragg,
speaking as though the boys were not at the table.
"One got taken during a fob raid near Fayetteville. Lord knows what hellhole the Blues are keeping him in now, if they haven't already killed him. The other strapped on a farmer's suit and sneaked himself past the wire. Made it all the way up to Kentucky. Then got himself shot dead outside a checkpoint before he could even get the damn thing to blow. My old man signed off on both, too. Neither kid had so much as fired a pistol in his whole life, but he okayed it anyway."
Bragg turned to Surratt. "But with you, he wouldn't hear it. Couldn't imagine a girl out there fighting. If it wasn't for Gaines' pull with him, no way he would have changed his mind.
Anyway, he'll want to see you, so you can plead your case to him. Maybe he'll give you a second chance."
"I don't plead with no one," said Surratt. "Your old man is nothing to me. He ain't my boss, ain't my father. I don't need his permission. You got something you need to say to him? Go on and say it yourself."
"I'd rather just wait for him to die, if I'm being honest," said Bragg. He waited on the sisters for a reaction, and got none.
"You know, he was 56 when he had me. 56? That's a goddamn half-century between us. How am I supposed to bridge that? He's caught up in the old way of doing things, still thinks he's in the desert, still fighting the old faraway war. All that tradition he's saddled with, it's too late to shake it off. Better just to wait him out and hope they haven't raised the blue banner over Atlanta before he finally has the decency to die."
The conversation was interrupted by a chorus of hooting and applause on the other side of the room. A piece of gossip moved around the dining hall, and all those who heard it responded with happy cursing and calls for another round.
"What are they so pleased about?"
Bragg asked one of his bodyguards. The guard inquired with a waitress and returned to whisper something to his boss. The shine came off Bragg's smile. He turned to Surratt. "Was it you who did it?" he asked. For the first time that evening, Surratt afforded herself a smile.
"Jesus Christ," said Bragg.
And then he finally did lower his voice.
"You poker-faced bitch.
You've gone and changed the whole damn war." Surratt winked. Bragg turned to his bodyguard. "Free up another couple seats at the Citadel," he said. "We got some real celebrating to do." A long line formed outside the doors of the Citadel. It was mostly young men waiting on the fight. A roving squad of doormen monitored the crowd. Whenever anyone got too loud or an altercation broke out, the bouncers quickly removed all parties involved. A couple of street vendors traversed the lineup. One sold Dixie cups of Joyful, brewed in the row houses down the street. Another hawked peanuts and roasted corn. The young men waited for the doors to open, and when they finally did, they shoved at one another on the way upstairs to the nosebleeds. The Yuffsie was fought at midnight on the turn of every month. There were other, smaller fights that took place at the Citadel at other times, but only on this night did all 12 contenders gather for the big money bout. Some fans came from as far as Mississippi to see it, the great southern spectacle of battering men. The Citadel used to be the grand rotunda of an old museum. It was a fine and high-roofed lobby. Inside the ring, the floor was padded, but the padding was thin, and a man thrown onto it with sufficient force could feel resonating in his bones the marble tiles below. The rotunda's central circle was bound into an octagon by fencing that ran all the way up to the second-story balcony. Most of the spectators sat in the balcony, but on the first floor, ringside, there were 2 dozen seats reserved for Augusta's gilded class. Southern government leaders, celebrities from Atlanta, foreign captains in town for the weekend, and whoever else wielded sufficient cash or clout. Bragg and the Chestnuts sat in those chairs, dead center and near the wide double doors from behind which the fighters would soon emerge. Popcorn and wild invective rained down from the balcony seats. The lights dimmed. A strafe of thundering rock descended from the speakers overhead. The doors swung open to savage applause. The fighters walked barefoot, dressed only in shorts. Some wore bands around their heads and compression sleeves on their arms or legs. The sleeves were decorated in bright colors, reds and yellows and greens, adorned with lightning bolts and tiger's fangs and the stars of the southern flag. The men bore tattoos of crosses and Bible verses and razor wire and the names of kin. They walked into the cage, eyes dead ahead, as though no crowd existed. Soon the lights rose, and the music died, and the cage door was closed. The 12 men stood, sizing each other up, planning paths of attack. Conventional wisdom said there was no way to win a Yuffsie in the opening minute, but plenty of ways to lose. Many fighters, when the bell rang, opted not to pounce on the weakest-looking of the bunch, but the slowest, someone with whom they could safely spar without appearing cowardly, as the other men thinned their own ranks. But rarely did such tactics work as intended, and often 2 men who targeted the same sluggish Goliath would find themselves instead compelled to fight each other. The chaotic nature of the sport ensured that a dollar bet on any fighter was a dollar bet almost at random, and any man who managed to win even 3 or 4 fights before retiring was considered to have had a stellar career. The ringside announcer read the fighters' names. A couple were new to the circuit, and had likely been included by the Fightmaster simply because they looked big and granite-jawed enough to stay on their feet for at least a few minutes before going down. The defending champion was a 19-year-old from Hattiesburg named Joshua, who fought under the moniker Wraith. There was a rumor he had once spent time with the Sovereigns, fighting in East Texas when he was only 13. It was a lie invented by his manager, in part to blunt another rumor, started by a rivals' camp, that the fighter was in fact the son of Northerners and had signed a deal with a promoter in Pittsburgh in anticipation of war's end. A victory on this night would mark 3 consecutive Yuffsies for Wraith, an unprecedented run in a contest where the previous winner always walked into his next cage match centered in 11 men's crosshairs. Only one contender interested Surratt. A veteran named Taylor. She'd heard of him a long time ago in Camp Patience. He had lived there once, before the massacre. She knew little about him or his people, whether they had left with him and, if not, whether any of them had survived. She only knew that he'd lived once in the South Carolina slice, and that now, almost a decade of fighting under his belt in a competition where the average fighter's career lasted 4 months, his body was irreversibly broken. Surratt ignored the other fighters and watched only him. The bell rang. A cheer rose from the balcony. The men stalked one another and soon were sparring. In a UFC, a man left the ring only one of three ways, by tapping out, sustaining an injury brutal enough to warrant a retreat to the cage's only door, or by being knocked unconscious. In which latter case, a couple of octagon clowns were dispatched to drag the fighter out of the ring. In order to maintain the UFC's appeal as the South's true outlaw sport, the organizers were loath to put any rules on the books, and, strictly speaking, the 12 men who entered the cage every month were bound by no written code. But in reality, an elaborate system of unsaid conventions regulated the melee. An honor code concerning sucker punches and the length of time a man may avoid his opponents. A fighter clearly headed for the exit should be left alone, for example. But there was no actual punishment for violating these rules. The night's bout raged on, but no man fell. At the 12-minute mark, all 12 fighters were still standing. The crowd applauded the dozen-dozen, a rarity. But by 15 minutes, half the fighters had left the cage. Four on their own power, bloodied and limping. Two dragged out by the clowns, unconscious. The exits came as they always did, in a cascade. As soon as the shame of being the first fighter down was gone, the men's threshold for pain suddenly plummeted, and those who knew they had little chance of winning were almost happy to find themselves in a headlock or an armbar from which they could tap out. Bragg leaned over to Surratt.
"Your old neighbor has a busted foot," he said.
Taylor, from Patience, shifted hard onto his right leg, his left foot swollen and purple at the ankle. Only he, the champion Wraith, and one of the last-minute entrants, a behemoth named Grayson, remained. As it did toward the end of every UFC, the cage, whose padding was now streaked with drying blood, looked too large for its occupants. Instinctively, the men stepped back from each other and took a moment to catch their breath. A large gash had opened over Grayson's right eye. He wiped the blood with the compression sleeve on his arm. Soon, the crowd grew tired of inaction and began heckling the men, demanding action. It was Taylor who moved first, limping toward Grayson. But before he got to him, Grayson raised his hand in surrender and made for the door. A chorus of boos erupted from the balcony. The crowd enraged that a man they believed still capable of fighting had chosen not to. They tossed peanuts and popcorn at the fighter as he left, calling him a coward and an embarrassment to the cage. Grayson made no response. Quickly, he was shepherded beyond the great double doors to the fighters' quarters, a repurposed exhibition room in the bowels of the old museum that once housed the bones of dinosaurs. Two men remained, and although one of them had gone into the ring the favorite, the other now commanded the audience's affection. A few cheered because they knew the hopeless challenger came from the site of the famous Blue Massacre, others because they knew he had failed to win a UFC in 23 tries, a record. But most cheered because of an innate desire to back the underdog. That he stood no chance against his youth-armored opponent only endeared him further to the roaring crowd. Instinctively, they expected of him the same chivalrous defiance they believed they themselves, placed in the same position, would show. The champ approached. He was wiry, his veins embossed in skin. The challenger struggled to hide his impairment. But it was more than the useless left ankle, which forced him now to skip and skitter where he stood, that hobbled him. It was an exhaustion in the very being of him, the weight of all his previous fights compounded. The champ saw his advantage and played it. A swift kick to the swollen ankle brought the challenger down. Quickly, the champ jumped onto him and with a barrage of three quick punches, broke the challenger's nose along the bridge where it had been broken many times before. In such instances, when a UFC was down to just two men, one of whom was obviously on the verge of defeat, a broken nose was the customary way to end the fight with mutual dignity. All the challenger had to do was tap out or lie still on the ground. The crowd would not begrudge him for doing either. The champion, kneeling atop the challenger, paused and waited. But the challenger refused. Instead, the bloodied, broken fighter swung a fist upward at his opponent. So surprised was the champ by this that he failed to block it, and the punch landed square on his jaw, although it had so little weight behind it that it did no damage. The champ responded with another barrage, the challenger's head knocked side to side as though readying to come loose from his spine. Once again, the champ waited, and once again, the challenger refused to submit. He swung from where he lay, this time unable to close his fist, such that he succeeded only in slapping the champ on the shoulder. The crowd, now uncertain, grew quiet, nervous with the thought that the champ would inevitably lose patience. But instead, the champ stood up. He left the challenger where he lay, a crimson halo on the padding near his head. He walked to the edge of the cage, near where the trainers were seated. He raised his hands in exasperation.
"What you waiting for?" said the champ's trainer. "I gave him a chance to go out easy," the fighter replied. "What do you want me to do? Kill him? If he don't want to get killed, he'll tap out," the trainer said. "Do your goddamn job."
As they spoke, the challenger stumbled onto his one working foot. He limped toward the edge of the cage and threw himself against the body of the champ. There was nothing left of him now but weight, and with it, he knocked his opponent back against the side of the cage and onto the ground. The champ screamed in pain as he fell. An unsmooth protrusion in the mesh of the cage had cut a deep gash all the way along the length of his chest. Blood poured from the wound and spilled out the boundaries of the ring. In a moment, the champ was standing again. Enraged, he knelt over his motionless opponent and beat him until the trainers and the crowd and all who watched knew he was dead. The lights rose, the crowd dispersed. Usually the young men who came to watch the fight left afterward with adrenaline coursing through their veins, and were apt at the slightest provocation to start brawling with one another in the back alleys south of the boardwalk. But on this night, the crowd was muted, and diffused quietly to the Imperial and the other Reynolds Street bars. Adam Bragg Jr., fully drunk now, invited the sisters back to the Woodrow, where he and his entourage had booked every room for the weekend. But it was clear his interest lay in only one of the twins, and both declined. Surratt and Dana stood a while on the boardwalk, watching the docks. In the wake of the big winter storms, the wash often broke over the seawall. Tonight, the water moved like black molasses. Even the massive freight ships, the first of which should have started to arrive at port by now, were nowhere to be seen.
"A guy at the fight said one of the gift ships ran aground all the way out at the mouth," said Dana.
"They're here every month," Surratt replied. "How do they still manage to screw it up?"
"The land shifts under the water. Places that were deep one season turn shallow the next, and unless you're out there every day, you can't know it."
Surratt watched the men down in the reef pilot's house. The lights were on. They were drinking and playing cards and passing time, hoping for the call to head out to the mouth, the gaping waterway where the ocean met the river near the drowned remains of old Savannah. Others had already joined the tugboats dispatched to rescue the freighter. Because it was a day's work and, even though the reef pilots earned a better living than almost any legal job in Augusta offered, they could still use the money.
"You going to meet that pretty boy of yours tonight?" asked Surratt.
"You know I am," said Dana. "Don't go making a big deal when it ain't. We're just seeing each other is all. It's just fun. I'll be there when you get up in the morning."
"He's not even a real pilot."
"He's in training. Everybody's got to learn to do a thing before they do it. Got to get taught."
"He's not good enough for you."
Dana laughed.
"You tell me one man you think he is."
She took her sister's hand and kissed it.
"I'll see you soon, beautiful girl."
Surratt knew where her sister would be spending the night. The Fargo Shipping Building on 7th Street. It was a block-wide, bureaucratic-looking thing. And amassed within it were the reef pilot trainee dorms, the shipping authority and customs offices, the foreign crew's hostel, and the North Georgia branch of the Free Southern State. Surratt despised the place,
It spoke to her of all the unnecessary adornments with which her country's institutions justified their own existence. In truth, the customs officers were crooked. The hostel, a thinly disguised brothel, and the temporary storage units in the basement used almost exclusively by smugglers. It was, all of it, a lie. And the worst kind of lie. A charade of normality at a time of war. The thought of her sister inside that building, lying on one of those soiled bunks with one of those vacant, libidinous boys, made her sick. Alone, she went to the Belle Rebelle to drink and then to sleep. It was a small bar, built inside one of the old row houses between 10th and 11th Streets. Upstairs, the owner, Layla Denome, kept three rooms. Some nights, she rented them out, but most of the time, she let old friends and regulars stay there for free. Layla's 16-year-old daughter, Layla Jr., had been pouring drinks there for the last 2 years, standing atop a Yuxi crate to see over the bar top. She knew the regulars by name, and Surratt by more. Of the Belle Rebelle's die-hard regulars, there were predominantly two groups. The first were stump-limbed war pensioners. They sat at the back tables, growing rust and getting eyes shut drunk on Atlanta's dime. The others were river rats, reef pilots, tugboat and towboat captains, and the men who ran skiffs laden with contraband in the dead of night. These patrons sat at a corner of the bar, congregated near a large screen mounted on the back wall. The screen showed the position and status of the freighters as they approached and navigated the river. Whenever one of the charity ships needed a reef pilot or a batch of dockhands to help with unloading, a notice popped up on the screen. The simple screen was, for the bar owner, a coup, the result of a years-long relationship with the proprietor of one of the very few working commercial satellites that still covered this slice of the world. On this night, the screen showed that the freighters, which should by now have been working their way upriver to Augusta, were instead log-jammed behind the ship that had run aground. The workers nursed watered down joyful and cursed their lousy luck. "If he's got any sense, he'll stay on that goddamn boat and hope they take his ass all the way back to China," said one of the reef pilots. "He comes back here, they'll string him up on the boardwalk." Surratt sat at the other end of the bar, where Layla, the elder, leaned on the bar top, eating frickles. "Baby girl," she said, hugging Surratt. "Gaines said you'd be coming around soon. It's so good to see you." "How you been, Mama Layla?" said Surratt. The bar owner shrugged. "The same. Bad night tonight. This talking might be another couple days before they get that ship moving. People are starting to worry about credit, about paying last month's bills." "Is there a storm out there or something?"
"Nah, they just had one called Walter. Was a Cat 6 coming in off the Gulf 4 days ago, but died real quick over the Florida Sea. Just some rain and wind now, gave the gift ship captains a little trouble out past the borderline, but nothing too bad."
"Then what's keeping them?" asked Surratt. "It can't just be that one stuck ship. Are the Blues tightening up inspections again?" Layla shook her head.
"Just the one stuck ship. Can you believe it? They sent this new pilot out, a kid named Brunswick. Hasn't been certified no more than a week, and they sent him out to guide the first gift ship in. Well, don't you know, he's running off last season's map, and he guides them too far south. First damn ship of the month, and he runs them aground into Hutchinson Reef."
"So they're just sitting there?"
"Been there since dusk. FSS Shipping Authority folks being real hard asses about letting other ones go around it. I think they finally saw a chance to flex their muscles. But now everybody's just waiting on them to pull her out and tow her in."
"Christ," said Surratt. "Can't run a ship up a river. How are we supposed to win a war?" She picked at the bowl of frickles. Layla, who swore up and down that nobody could tell the difference, made them with cricket flour. But Surratt swore she could. There was a stale aftertaste to it, a dishwater echo on the tongue. Layla called on her daughter to bring over a carafe of Joyful. The girl poured Surratt a cup.
"How are those boys doing?"
asked the mother, pointing to the reef rats at the corner of the bar.
"They're asking if they can start a tab on next month's ships, if these ones end up turning around."
"What did you tell them?"
"You know what I told them."
"Good girl." Layla Jr., walked back to the other end of the bar. Surratt watched her. She had her hair in a thick, braided ponytail. Behind it, on the back of her neck, lay a small tattoo of the state of Georgia that her mother had yet to discover.
"How's your family?"
asked Layla Sr.
"They're all right," said Surratt.
"Gaines' friend Dr. Heller came by again last month, talking about how they're working on a program at the Red Crescent where they send injured Southerners up to the good hospitals in Pittsburgh. I told him I'd rather Simon die."
"What's the harm in it? It's not like you're turning on your people. What if they got something up there in those hospitals can fix them?"
"Unless they got a time machine in those hospitals, they ain't fixing them." Layla sighed. She poured herself a glass of Joyful.
"How about the letters? Gaines said you've been sending them back."
"We don't need donations," said Surratt. "Every week they come in from all over the Red. People I've never met before. Some of them I know don't even have a pot to piss in, and they still send us envelopes stuffed with cash, like we're a church or something. Well, we ain't a church. We don't need their charity."
Layla laughed. "Oh, honey, I know that. Knew it the minute Gaines first introduced us. But what you need to know is, it isn't about you. It's about them. You really think those folks are too dumb to know they're poor? Of course they know. And they send you that money anyway, because it means that much to them to be connected to you."
"What do they know about us?" Surratt replied. "What they read in the papers? What those FSS politicians said in those rallies? For all they know, they're milling the cash to a hole in the ground."
"The only thing they need to know is you're clean," said Layla. "You and your sister and your brother, especially your brother, you're clean because of what was done to you at Patience. All the politicians and the rebels and even the preachers, they might say the right things, but they haven't been made clean like you. That's why they send you money. That's why they write you those letters saying you're in their prayers. Because you're clean."
"That's not true," said Surratt.
"Oh, it's true. It might not be reasonable. It might not be fair. But it's true.
If they want to be clean so bad, why are they sitting in their homes writing letters? Why aren't they out fighting, or even saying they're proud of the South, proud of their own side? Every time I read the J-Con or any other one of those Southern newspapers, they've got some article about a new poll showing more and more people in favor of those cowards at the FSS and their phony peace plan. A plan that don't ask for nothing but free movement over our own land. If they're so worried about being clean, whatever that means, they'd hang those cowards in Atlanta with their pocket line and stuffed in their mouths."
A cheer erupted from the other corner of the bar. At first, Surratt thought the river workers had been listening to what she said, but it was the movement of the ships they were cheering. The red dot that had been stalled atop Hutchinson Reef finally turned green, and to the east, the waiting freighters began to move upriver. The month's parade of gift ships was underway.
"Won't be needing that credit after all, sweetheart," said one of the dockhands as he raced from the bar.
"Wasn't gonna be getting it anyway," said Layla Jr.
The dockhand blew her a kiss as he left, and she returned it with a finger. Soon, the bar was quiet save for the murmuring of the war pensioners. The men, a half dozen on this night, were between 10 and 20 years older than Surratt, but looked older. She knew them only vaguely. The one missing his legs was Nathan something. The one next to him was named Jeb and was paralyzed on his left side. Others who drank in the Belle Rebelle's dark corners on this and other nights were broken in other ways, some cracks visible, some not. Layla Sr. pointed to the men.
"You want people who'll never stop supporting the war? Talk to them over there. The war will never be over for them. The people who are sending you those letters? I bet you most of them aren't yet damaged that way. Maybe they've been touched by it, lost a friend, or heard about some massacre, but it's not the same. The truth is, they're on the other side of the river from where you are. They haven't been through what you've been through. And they don't want to. They're not young like you. Most of them are old enough to remember when it wasn't like this. When there was peace. And if you'd known that, you'd want it back too."
"It ain't coming back," said Surratt. "If they want a dream, that's their choice." Layla cupped her hands on Surratt's. There was a warmth to her palms that seemed to emanate from her eyes.
Maybe, she said. Maybe. But let me ask you this, and be honest. If they did have a time machine up in that northern hospital, and you had a chance to go back to a time when none of what happened to you happened, a different world altogether where there had never been any war, wouldn't you take it?
Doesn't matter, said Surratt. They can't ever make that happen.
But if they could, they can't.
The bar owner smiled. It was a sad smile. And behind it, Surratt suspected something akin to pity.
It's getting late, she said.
They're going to be out on the docks unloading all night, and then tomorrow the shirt factory dealers are going to join them, and it'll be a carnival for 3 days straight.
She passed a set of room keys to Surratt.
Get some sleep while you can, she said. Room's all set up how you like it.
Surratt thanked her. They hugged, and Layla retired to her own home, which stood about 10 blocks south of the boardwalk, insulated from the riverside cacophony. Layla Jr. rang the bell.
Last call.
Surratt finished off the joyful in her cup, and she stumbled off her chair. She climbed the stairs near where the pensioners were getting ready to leave for the dime bag motels and the VFWs, repurposed now as VDWs, Veterans of Domestic Wars. As she climbed the stairs, she leered at Layla Jr., who caught her eyes but said nothing. The bedroom upstairs was small. The bed was made of a steel bunk salvaged from a ruined southern destroyer. The bunk bed's frames had been severed from each other and reset side by side to make a crude double bed. A lamp lit the room, its light sinking into the brown-painted walls. A ceiling fan spun, its bamboo arms warped and wobbling. A small window overlooked the boardwalk and the docks and the river. Surratt smelled the sheets. They'd been recently washed, and they smelled of jasmine. It was the first thing she did whenever she stayed at the Belle Rebelle. The scent of other people on the sheets disgusted her. If she ever detected it, even the slightest remains of another body's signature. She stripped the sheets from the bed and slept on the naked mattress, or on the floor, where the dust tempered all other scents. On the nightstand, there was an old music player, the kind that carried songs in its own memory instead of fetching them from the clouds. It had once belonged to Layla's mother, and had reached that useless middle age between novelty and antique. It was simply old. Surratt searched it for a song she'd heard before, a slow number she liked. The player had a little display on its face, but that had long ago stopped working. Instead, she listened, and skipped past song after song, until she found the one she wanted. From the speakers came the sound of bourbon-clouded piano keys, a shredded nightgown of a song. You moved like honey in my dream last night. Surratt undressed. She set her shirt over the lampshade, and the soft light turned from amber to blood. The shirt depicted the flag of South Carolina, drawn against a red background instead of blue. Surratt listened. Layla Jr.'s footsteps were light against the stairs outside. She opened the door. With her apron off, she appeared even smaller, a milk-skinned apparition under Surratt's looming shadow. She closed the door behind her.
Come here, said Surratt.
Say it nicer,
Layla replied.
No.
Surratt smiled. She wanted Layla to stand her ground. And Layla knew Surratt wanted it, because it made what came next sweeter, made the roughness sweeter. And it was the roughness Surratt craved. She wanted not love itself, but the taking and giving of it, the parched hardness of her tongue scraping along Layla's skin, a harvest of goosebumps in its wake. She wanted her to feel love the way a bone feels a break, to make her scream in a language she never even knew she knew. A language deposited from her lips like secrets into the vault of a muffling pillow. She wanted it to hurt, and for Layla to want it to hurt. The sound of them seeped through the brittle bedroom window and was drowned by the bustle of the docks. Outside, the river rats worked the cranes and the trucks, readying to relieve the gift ships of their contents. Soon the freight ships would arrive, and their cargo of rations and tent materials and charity blankets would be moved throughout the Red. Then, in the days that followed, the ships would be loaded with their reward in the Great Barter, crate upon crate of clothing from the Southern shirt factories, cheap electronics from the sweatshops along the Alabama coast, fruits and vegetables from Atlanta's vertical farms. Then the ships would depart, and Augusta would grow quiet once more, the giving and taking complete. Layla's heartbeat echoed in the springs. Surratt rolled away. The fan turned slow, easy circles overhead. She felt Layla's finger on her back, tracing a wound. The cut was thin and long, running from the top of her left shoulder to the middle of her back.
"How did you get this?"
asked Layla.
"Don't know," said Surratt.
"Yeah, you do. You just don't want to tell me."
"That's right."
Layla sat up in bed. She leaned over and picked her shirt off the floor and put it on. It was stretched out a little around the collar from when Surratt had pulled it off her. Outside on the boardwalk, there shone a great blinking lantern. A sliver of its light came in through the bedroom window. It cast Layla momentarily in a wash of white, and in this moment, the places where her skin was red and flush were made porcelain and clean, the newness of her restored.
"This is my last year in this place," she said. "Come January, I'm gone."
"And where exactly are you going to go to?"
asked Surratt, her back still turned.
"South, to Valdosta, where my mother grew up. All her people are still there."
Surratt chuckled.
"Everybody trying to get the hell out of the South Coast, and you're going back?"
"Better there than here,"
said the girl.
"I'm not going to wait on drunk river rats and clean up puke for the rest of my life. Wake up one day, find out now I'm the old Layla. At least down there I don't have to worry every day about whether this will be the night the blues finally come down from Tennessee, burn the whole place to the ground.
Only reason blues won't come all the way down to Valdosta is because there's nothing down there worth burning,"
said Surratt.
"What are you going to do? Work in one of the farm slums? The shirt mills?"
"Maybe I will."
Surratt shook her head.
"Christ," she said. "You still so young. Like you ain't."
Surratt faced her.
"Turn around," she said.
Layla complied. Surratt brushed aside her ponytail and kissed the place where Georgia's outline lay inked upon her neck.
"Run off wherever you like," she said. "You mine tonight, though."
"I ain't nobody's,"
Layla replied. But she lay a while longer under the slow-turning fan. Then she was gone, and Surratt slept. She dreamed of patience, and of the knife coming loose from her hand too soon. In the dream, the blues bound her and took her north, to a place in the forest. They dug for her a prison well deep into the ground, a dark, earthen hollow from which she could not climb. It was always the same. Every night, she closed her eyes and was confined to the empty well, powerless and blind and alone. She woke with the residue of the nightmare in her pores. For a moment, she scratched at the mattress, but a warm hand patted her head, and a voice said,
"It's all right, beautiful girl. It's all right."
She let her sister's breathing calm her and smelled the skin of her thigh. She let the lullaby wash over her.
"It's all right, beautiful girl. It's all right, beautiful girl."
But she held her own eyes closed because she knew that the voice and smell and touch of her sister were not real. They were only imagined things, concocted by her mind to cleanse the aftertaste of the nightmare. When she finally opened her eyes, her sister would not be there. Outside, the docks rattled with the movement of commerce. All morning, the crews unloaded the boxes. By noon, when Surratt could no longer keep her eyes closed, the opposite process was underway. Surratt walked to the window. The room was dank, despite the fan's slow circling. Still naked, she lifted the window open and leaned out to catch a little of the Savannah breeze. The boardwalk looked old and weathered in the clear light of day. A couple of drunks lay asleep in their vomit. A freight ship blocked the view of the river, but Surratt could still see on